Welcome back to Dark Florida, the show where we explore eerie true crime, historical oddities, cryptid sightings, paranormal encounters, and strange news that defy explanation. We examine hidden patterns and the darker questions that live just beneath the surface. I'm your host, Brooke Moreland. Before we get started, I just want to say thank you to everyone who continues to listen and share the show. If you would like to stay connected with Dark Florida, you can find us on Instagram at Dark Florida Podcast and on YouTube at youtube.com/@darkflorida411. And if you have a story to share or would like to be a guest on the show, you can email me directly at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. And if you would like to support the show, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida. Or wherever you're listening, be sure to drop a 5-star review and share the show with a friend. It really helps. Now, this week, we are going to dive into Stanley Kubrick's work and look at some of his films. Now, some films are meant to entertain us, and others feel like there's something more. Stanley Kubrick's work has lingered in the collective consciousness for decades. Not because it gives us answers, but because it leaves us with questions we can't quite shake. Questions about power, control, trauma, and the systems operating quietly beneath everyday life. This week's conversation, we're going to be exploring the possibility that Kubrick was doing something much deeper, and that his films weren't just stories. My guest today is Sean McCann of Wake the Dead, whose work examines Stanley Kubrick not just as a filmmaker, but as a communicator. What follows is a conversation about patterns, perception, and what happens when art refuses to stay on the surface. So with that in mind, let's dive into this week's conversation. Sean, welcome to Dark Florida. I am so excited to have you here with us this week. A lot of the conversations that we have here live in that space in between what we're shown and what we're meant to notice. And your work on Stanley Kubrick suggests that his films may exist in that same sort of in-between space where it's not quite fiction and not quite confession. So to open things up for maybe the guests who don't know who you are, welcome to the show.
Well, hello. Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm delighted that you have looked at my work and you think it's interesting enough to speak about it. My name is Sean McCann and I run a podcast titled Wake the Dead. And you can find that pretty much anywhere, Spotify, Google, Amazon. And you can also find me on a limited amount of my videos are on YouTube and everything else is on Spotify, BitChute, and Rumble if anybody wants to find my stuff. And I have a webpage that I gave you and you can link below. So yeah, I'm a thinking individual who has a moral compass and I have been aware for many years and I started this podcast maybe 5 years ago and I've just been charging right along. And I'm a photographer and I like to look at film and still pictures, and Stanley Kubrick is a genius at that. And even when I was in school for photography, Kubrick was on the list of what we were learning about. And we would see his still pictures from when he was in high school and when he worked for Look magazine. So I was always aware of Kubrick as a photographer, and I was a big fan of his work. And then I fell down the rabbit holes maybe 20 years ago, and I discovered what was hidden there, and I was able to recontextualize the work in a way that it teaches me something new. I got really excited about that and blasted it out to everybody. I was like telling everybody on Facebook a long time ago, and everybody's like, okay, here goes Sean again talking about Eyes Wide Shut. They were sick of hearing it. but I'm glad that I was able to channel it into a way that people that are interested in listening can find it. And I'm glad you did. So thank you.
Absolutely. So you said that about 20 years ago, your perspective changed. And I find that that is something that happens with symbolism, which is once you have the eyes to see it, it starts appearing everywhere and you just can't ignore it. So what was that first moment that you realized that Kubrick wasn't just making movies and telling stories, but that he was possibly revealing something through his work?
Well, I had the general idea. I'd seen Room 237, the documentary, and I know the basic, I know about MK Ultra, and I know Clockwork Orange is kind of, you know, about that. And I recognized themes and stuff. But with my own show, I was doing deep research into satanic ritual abuse and that phenomenon of creating a total slave that is unaware that they even are a slave. I'm sure you're familiar and your listeners are familiar with this. It's called trauma-based mind control. And I was learning a lot about that, and I saw the symbols on the screen, and I'm like, what Kubrick is saying? He's got a ping pong table in Lolita. He's got cheese pizza and Eyes Wide Shut. He's got the spiral and the O of rainbow and under the rainbow, which is this, in Eyes Wide Shut, it's the store underneath the costume shop. So, and then I saw Room 237 again, and I listened to John Fell Ryan talk about how Helena is kidnapped at the end, and everything clicked. I was like, of course. Alice is a multiple, she is a fracture. Sure, her self is fractured into multiple personalities, and she's controlled, and she's a total slave. And they abducted her daughter to do the same to the next generation. That's how it's done, in that they even use monarch as a thing because of the genetic memory that monarch butterflies give to their young. The trait of dissociation is passed on genetically. It's epigenetic. The triggers are turned on before birth. So the kid is more easily susceptible to the abuse that will happen later in its life. So that all of a sudden, it was like, bing. And then I saw everything fit that. And I'm like, I'm not crazy. Other people can see. And so I made this occult Kubrick and the butterfly net presentation. It was a while ago, and it was basically, it just laid out everything. And even on the poster of Eyes Wide Shut, he's got Alice looking in the looking glass, and Alice in Wonderland is big for that trauma-based mind control and those symbolism they use heavily. And the mirror that Kubrick chose is an octagon. It's got eight sides, not just four, which represents to the mental prison of the Tesseract, which is also in this movie. And there's these little convex bubbles all around the outside of the mirror. When Alice is looking in the center of the mirror, there's 100 other little Alices in all those little convex little circles. And I'm recognizing, holy crap, that's all the multiple personalities. That's her. And she's switching in the mirror in that moment. Everything makes sense. And so the more you read about Bryce Taylor or Kathy O'Brien or these experiencers of SRA, I mean, you see it right there. That's what Eyes Wide Shut is. And all the symbolism relates to that. And Metamorphoses and Ovid, and it just goes on and on. And I contacted other Kubrickologists, I guess, and I asked them their opinion. I was like, can't you see? Look at this. And they're like, I don't like conspiracies. You know, I don't want to think about that. And I was like, wow. And so I was like, I guess I'm the only one that thinks this. And so I just created the presentation, and you know, I've been talking about it, and I haven't stopped looking, and I'm still learning new stuff all the time. Like, I just learned recently about the Order of the Golden Fleece, and they wear the same color red as that carpet and the guy with the gold mask at the ritual. And they have, since 1913, they were given reinstated the power of sanctifying a place for holy mass. And so that's what that guy with the red cloak is doing. He's got the Thurible, and he's blessing the place so that they can have an actual Roman Catholic Mass there. And only the Order of the Golden Fleece can do that. Every other Mass has to be at a church, unless they got one of these guys who is connected to the Habsburgs and the royal domination of all of Europe, and even the New World is owned by this. It goes deep.
Yeah. What do you think about the new pictures that have come out from Epstein Island showing all of the Mass? Those Mass looked eerily similar.
I haven't seen that.
No.
The new photos I have not seen. I saw that they were released.
There were just some pictures that were released of one of the rooms in there. And I believe it was where they had the dental chair, but on the wall, there were all these different types of Mass. And even in his office, he had what could only be described as like one of those eyes wide shut Mass. So I thought that was really interesting, especially with the kind of character that Epstein was, and then how that paralleled what we saw in the movie. What do you think that in the movie, like, do you think that the Mass represent that anonymity, or does it represent the rank within the organization?
There's a lot going on. So these are masks from Venice, and the bankers of Venice are related to the story, kind of. The rich families that owned the trade and owned the world at the time. The masks serve a purpose for the ritual itself. The ritual is a breeding thing. All the men participate, and they all wear masks, so that erases the paternal lineage. That's what the real purpose is, because they need to have a pool of genetic material that is worthy. They have to have used their, but they're not going to have it be an actual heir. It has to be severed from the lineage of this rich family. Can't let them have any of our riches, right? There's a lot to it as far as that's concerned, but the masks erase the paternal lineage, I think.
Gotcha. And didn't he pass away before this movie was actually released?
Yeah. It's spooky because he passed away 666 days before 2001, which is kind of spooky. I mean, he was of ill health, and he was stressing himself out a lot, and he was smoking again. Christian said that his wife said that he was not very healthy at that point. So it could have been natural causes, but it could have been the heart attack gun that we saw at the church committee.
I've heard some speculation around his death. We've talked just about Eyes Wide Shut, but even with him, some of his other films like The Shining and potentially him helping fake the moon landing footage, there's a lot. He was a really complex individual.
Right.
And it seemed like he sort of was revealing a lot in through his work for those who could dive into the symbolism. Like you said, it was so coded that there's even things that you can look at it for the 100th time and see something new.
Yeah.
Do you think that part of what he was doing may have led to his ultimate demise? Because from what I'm told is that the Eyes Wide Shut that was filmed, that there was a lot of things that were left out of the final film that he had wanted in there.
Well, that is a rumor. And I do not believe that there was, I mean, people say there's like 23 minutes, 25 minutes. Cut. Actually, because I have watched this film so much, I discovered that it synchronizes with itself at 1 hour intervals. I mean, it's exact. I've put it together where I'll play from zero, and then when it gets to 1 hour exactly, I'll play a second screen and start that one from zero. And when that one gets to 1 hour, I'll play on a third screen. I call that the Fidelio experiment. And the moment where Nick Nightingale is writing Fidelio on the paper is like 1 hour into the film, and this is the password. And once you realize that this timeline is the password, when you lay it upon itself like this, it is exact. It's not random. So I believe that Kubrick built it this way to show us that it's complete, that this is the... And
I see what you're saying, because with it being on that level of precision, if there was hypothetically 23, 24 minutes that were cut out, it wouldn't have lined up with what you're saying. And imagine the forethought that would take to even pull something like that off is just mind-blowing, the calculation behind that.
Yeah, I think he's been working on that his whole career, because I continued to investigate into his other films as well, and I noticed that they also line up with Eyes Wide Shut. Like, exactly. I think The Shining crudely does self, it does synchronize with itself.
I think I've heard even that, at 1 hour. Actually.
Really?
That's yeah, I fantastic. Think I have heard that before. I think at one point, and don't quote me, but mm-hmm. it had the twins on the screen. And then at that exact next point, it had the elevator doors, which in a sense right. would be like symbolizing the twins.
Well, it's amazing, because the point where Jack is having the dream and he's screaming bloody murder and his wife runs up and she's like, "Are you okay?" And he tells her, "I dreamed I chopped you up in little pieces with an axe." That's at 1 hour. That's at the, that right there is the key, the password. You look at the other movies that, and it's not just the 1 hour minute, the 42 minutes, like it's all layered in. Like it's really sick. It's not just 1 hour. It's many points. And it's, I think that Eyes Wide Shut is his masterpiece of this. And I've even looked at some of his quotes, and he talks about the genius, because everybody would get on his case about how many times they would have to record the all the takes that they would have to do. And he would complain. Everybody's like, "Oh, he's such a perfectionist. And, oh, he does all these calculations and it's weird." And he says, "Yeah, but Napoleon would never have been a genius on the battlefield if his troops and his armies didn't arrive at the exact place at the exact time that they do." And he's trying to talk about how the genius is in the timing. He's alluding to that, and he's like kind of pushing at that. And I was like, that really sounds like he's trying to tell us to pay attention. If you look at, I did the same thing with the eyes with the Fidelio thing. I did the three screens of Fidelio, and then I added all the other films. It was 10 screens, and it's amazing, just utterly amazing. I mean, you see it yourself, you'll say, "Oh, wow." And you'll find things that I didn't find.
Right.
And that's, I think, is the true genius that Kubrick was working with, that I don't know, like, if others noticed that. I'm sure the other directors noticed, but he was in charge of all the editing. I've got clips of him, people that were helping him edit Barry Lyndon, and talking about the editing process. He would count how many frames. He would have this machine that would run on these Betamax tapes. It would have like 12 tapes, and you could swap out. You could have 12 takes of one scene, and you could be like, "I like how he says this part," and you use tape 5. "And I like how he says this part," and you use tape 10. And you splice them together. But these are Betamax. They can just stop one, start the other one, and see what it would look like when it was spliced. So he was really paying attention to the timing and where the words fell. It's really interesting to see.
And I saw a post the other day that showed that Stanley Kubrick, that in the one-point perspective of The Shining, that he used this composition that made all of these leading lines converge into that single point, which was in the center of the frame. So to the human eye, it creates this rigid sense of symmetry that feels unnatural. And it overlays these points throughout clips of the film. And it's crazy how that lines up.
Yes. So that is a tactic of photography. It creates attention. Usually with composition, you'll have something a little bit off to one side, you'll have, it won't be directly in the middle. Even with portraits, if the person is looking at the camera, it's off-putting. And being directly in the center, it creates a tension, for real. But I'll do you one further. How about, so have you ever heard of the Tesseract, the hypercube?
It sounds familiar.
Okay, so it is a four-dimensional cube as opposed to three. A point extruded is a line. If you extrude it into two dimensions, it's a line. In three dimensions, or the two dimensions, it's a plane. And then three dimensions, you extrude that out, it's into a cube. So if you visualize, which has to be done in this, it's weird the way that they represent a hypercube, but it is when you extrude the three dimension into four, it creates this double square, where the inner square is overtaking and becoming the outer square, and then the inner square is there again. It's this forever loop of extrusion, but the inner square is forever trapped by the trapezoids on its corners. And this is a very satanic idea. But so anyway, the tesseract, it is represented by a cube within a cube. Okay. And if you look down the hallway when Danny is driving his little big wheel, down the end of the hallway, the doors create like a square, and the outer frame around Danny is the outer square, the outer cube. And then as Danny rides his bike, the cube that was far away becomes the one around him. And now there's another cube further out down the hallway. So the act of him riding his bike through this hallway is creating the extrusion of that and creating the illusion of the tesseract happening. That is a very important thing that Kubrick was doing with the camera. And then when you recognize what those satanic symbols that represent mental slavery and domination of will, and then you see what room 237 was for Jack and how it became the trap for Jack, and the way that he drinks his drink that was given to him by Lloyd, that's like the signing of the contract with the demons. I believe that the Tesseract was representing the prison of Jack's soul is in. He is trapped in hell. And so the Overlook is hell. Mm. And when you have at the end, there's the tessellated array. They call it tessellated because it's a bunch of squares like that. And those squares are the infinity of the tesseract. You know, the square pattern is another way of representing the tesseract. And then there's Jack right in the middle, trapped in this timeless place. It says some other date, and long in the past he was here, but also in the future. That so the tesseract also represents the next dimension, where beyond time, where time is not a thing. It's this place where time doesn't make sense anymore. Like, that's what it's representing. That's the tesseract also. He's talking about the imprisonment of the soul. He's talking about the reality. Jack is an evil person, and it's he's doomed to continually chop his family up and be a murderous, disgusting person. And he has to live that in this place forever, in this timeless hell. He's thrown away by God, basically. I know that Kubrick was an atheist, but I believe he had a moral center. And these are all ways of describing morality. Like 42 even is related to the 42 affirmations of Ma'at and the whole Egyptian religion of 42 relates to morality and natural law and like your soul making it to the next level and not being thrown into the fire, you know?
Right. Well, it's interesting you bring up his morality, because that was a question that I had, which was, do you think that he was embedding those messages because he felt morally obligated to, or did he feel like that act of revealing it would somehow protect him?
I think he was already protected. I think he set himself up pretty good. He was in St. Albans, and there was going to be a world war. It's not going to land there. It's the center of the evil New World Order is England. I think he was protected pretty well. And I think that he was smart enough to use his power to keep himself in good standing and not. So he didn't need to reveal, I don't think, anything. He could have just died. But I think that just his humanity and being a real human, you can't not express how you feel on certain subjects. And they look at all his movies and they're like, look how depressing. But really, he's showing us the reality of humanity. I mean, it's really bad. And it's been manipulated that way by evil people. And even he worked for them. And I think that he had some remorse for that. I think that that's visible in his work. I mean, I think that Jay Widener talked about that. He gets pretty good at that, yeah, on that respect.
I think I've heard that he did have some level of remorse, especially like take, for example, if he was involved in faking the moon landing, which I would love to know where you land on that, but if he did have some remorse for being a part of such an elaborate hoax, that part of like clearing his conscience was leaving little Easter eggs or breadcrumbs in some of his films. Like when we see Danny wearing the Apollo 11 sweatshirt and different things like that, it goes far deeper.
Yeah, it does literally go far deeper, because the same moment when Danny is wearing that sweater and he's lifting up from the carpet and the whole thing that Jay Weiner talks about and how 37 million miles to the moon and the moon room and whatever, all of that, keep that in your mind. But then when you watch the Fidelio time code or something, whatever, I put all the 10 screens together, you'll see that the moment that Danny gets up and the rocket is lifting off is the same time when Nick Nightingale says, yeah, well, you got to go where the work is. And I want Jay Weiner to know that. So I hope that he watches the thing I put together. But yeah, it confirms even Jay's thing. When you see this mathematical way that he put together his films, it's even revealing stuff that others have picked up in other ways, and it's like just a confirmation. Yeah, okay. Yeah, you got to go where the work is. I don't think that Kubrick was actually the one behind the camera, because he was too busy making more money for them in other ways, but he could help them set it up. He could give them pointers, and they were they had NASA working with Kubrick for the 68 film 2001. And so it was all kind of overlapping. I think Wiedner had a lot going there, and the front point projection or whatever. I think that's a valid case. I think that all the moon footage is faked, but I wouldn't go as far as saying that Kubrick did it. I think that's a jump, but I do believe it's fake. No, I don't think they went to the moon. I think it's because if you look at really what government does, government and their entire thing is running on illusion. The whole thing is illusion. The Cold War was an illusion. The whole thing. So even now, with false flags, it's all illusions. So when they make a claim like we went to the moon, like, okay, prove that. How are you going to prove it? Oh, we got video. And like Nixon was talking on the phone to the moon. Come on, guys. It's so
silly.
That
part really gets me. I'm like, you mean to tell me that Nixon picked up his landline and called the moon? There's just no way.
And it's all on camera, and it's all like, you know, they got Ted Koppel or whoever and all the fanfare. Come on, guys.
I guess the biggest thing for me is that we've never been back. No other country has successfully gone back and done anything. And so you're telling me that we were able to do that in the 60s, but it's now 2025. We have Neuralink and we have all these amazing, wonderful things. And
Neuralink.
We're not gone to the moon.
Well, like feats of technology. It goes to show what the feats of technology, what they're focusing on is controlling the mind of the human. So Neuralink is what they want to do. And going to the moon is just a waste of money. They want to dominate humans. That's what it's always been. They want a new feudalism. They want a digital technocracy, feudalism, and they're going to get it. And they're going to either push it this way or that way or whatever. They got their movies. And the whole, like, Kubrick and his beautiful photography was great to dazzle people into thinking about space. And that was even, it helped with the whole fanfare of going to the moon. And everybody was also dosed on the LSD, and they were all going to the movie theater 10 times to see this going into the monolith that scene. So there was a lot of mind control kind of floating around. And I think that he knew he was creating a new myth, a whole new future civilization, right? And like it had to have mythology to give it a core. And so the satanic view is we were liberated from the bonds of earth over it now. But then from the Christian point of view, it's like we were cast out of the garden, we're in the depths of cold space, and everybody can see it and get something good from it. But I think that's what Kubrick knew he was doing, and he wanted to put all of his effort and his talent. And even if the Satanists win and they get their way, like, or not, like, he's still doing a wonderful piece of work, and he's given the keys to do that. And I think that his artistic desire to have the freedom to create. Like, I think it was hard for him to say no to them.
As far as him encoding these messages into his film, do you think that besides it just being on a symbolism level, was there any sort of overarching theme that you noticed with his work that he wanted to let people know? So I understand, like, his worldview was very different than ours. And like you talked about, time even not being linear and have it kind of in that loop there. Does his worldview, does that change how we interpret the symbolism that's in his films?
I think that the symbolism in his films only, it doesn't contradict. It only bolsters what he's saying. And really what I'm like, the symbolism that he's using is just, he's showing us the reality. Clockwork Orange has showed us how government hires a psychopath. At the end of the movie, they're like, we got a job for you. And his brain is still psychopathic. And he's like, yeah, I was cured. All right. And then his droog buddies were all cops. That's the real story, is the power system has psychopaths to enforce the power. Full Metal Jacket, same thing. You know, how do you make a regular American boy into a killer? Like, that's the government was trying to do in during the Vietnam War. They were trying to use mind control to make kids want to go kill strangers on the other side of the planet. None of them wanted to go, and they all had to, they had to draft them. And if you still believe the government's good thing, and then you go see in a Kubrick film and you see how the government is controlling. In the very beginning of 2001, the guy Floyd, his job is to create a fake press scenario to cover up the truth. This is the government covering up reality and giving falsehood. Like, Kubrick is revealing psychopathy and power and the human mind and its susceptibility to those things, and how easily we become slaves. And the different movies show you different levels. So this is what Kubrick is really showing us. What he's just trying to be a good artist and seeing how he can just say the message of reality over here now and over here now. Like, and then he relates his other, all his movies together. In The Shining, Wendy is reading, what's the one, the Masonic one, J.D. Salinger. It was the red book that the dude in Conspiracy Theory had to have in his pocket all the time.
Oh, Catcher of the Rye.
Catcher in the Rye, yeah. She was reading, yes. Catcher in the Rye, and Danny was watching Roadrunner, and he was eating his sandwich, and she's reading. And that mirrors exactly Alice and Helena. And Helena's eating her breakfast. She's watching Bugs Bunny, and Bugs Bunny is on the TV. And then they called Danny Doc because of Bugs Bunny cartoons. It's all one. And Danny had a split personality. Danny had this psychic ability because of the trauma. And so Danny is related to Helena as well because of these relations. So he's expanding on the same stories in different areas. Like Alice and Helena, they had split personalities that were manipulated and controlled by power systems that understood those things. And Danny was just happened to, as a survival mechanism, create another self.
When you talk about the systems of power that we see displayed throughout his movies, some saw it as Kubrick's work exposing those power systems, but there's also this underlying theme there that some of the systems were guided by something non-human. So whether that be demonic or fallen angels in nature, or you fill in the blank, where do you fall on that spectrum?
I believe those things occur. I do believe that there are non-corporeal entities that are influencing alive people. And I do believe the alive people use dark rituals to communicate with them. I know it's a lot to say right there, but I do think that Kubrick also saw those, or knew that reality. And that's what he was doing with Eyes Wide Shut. He was showing them in their robes and their masks and doing the guy was going in a counterclockwise fashion, and they were playing the tape of the blessing backwards. And very satanic. And Kubrick was like veiling and saying, there it is, everybody. Kubrick was aware. And I don't know if he believed in non-corporeal spirits, but he knew those people did. And he could see him dressing up weird like that, whether they believed it or not. They were still blackmailing each other.
Yeah, he really does obsessively repeat that imagery throughout his films. And it's interesting in that repetition is that a clue to that ritual that you were talking about.
Yeah, that ritual is placed on like 1 hour and 11 minutes, and then it starts at 1 hour and 13. If you see Clockwork Orange, the moment when Alex is tied down and he's got his eyes open and they're like putting the water in his eyes and making him watch the ultraviolence, that's when the ritual is happening. I think that ritual was put on that place in the timeline to show us about the other films. When we look at that point on the timeline and the other films, we learn, oh, that's why he saved it till last. Like, he was going to do Eyes Wide Shut after Lolita, and he was going to do it in the 70s with Steve Martin. He pushed it to the end, and then he even stopped doing AI and gave it to his buddy. Like, he was really understanding power, and he did real study, and he knew who he was working for. And I think that he needed to like make Eyes Wide Shut his main focus, to really put it everything in that one. But Eyes Wide Shut has the blackmail angle, has the elite power of, you know, elite families that go back to the Holy Roman Empire. And that's like what really matters. And I think that's why this one was his final masterwork.
That's really interesting that would be his last work.
Yeah. Yeah. It's if you think about the occultism and how 666 relates to the Kabbalah, and people are like Luciferian Kabbalists. And so those numbers mean something to them. 2001 is the first year of the new millennium. Like, 2000 is the end. 2001 is the beginning, right? That was their declaring year one, basically, of Satanism. I think that he knows that it's about human domination, and that's what he was describing in all his films. Even with the apes in 2001, they dominated the other ape and killed it with a bone. Then all the other apes had to join in with their death ritual. And now those apes are ascended to predator, and now they can evolve. That's what the whole thing is. Psychopathy is the problem with humanity. That's what Kubrick is revealing again and again, I think.
Right. Like, his overarching theme.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you asked about that earlier, but yeah, I think that's crystallized understanding psychopathy and human domination, that whole slavery thing.
Interesting.
But if you look at the timeline, mm-hmm. and you see when the events happen on the timeline, you see the numbers. So like 111, 42. And so there are these specific numbers when things happen. 7 minutes exactly is when Xandor Zavos drinks Alice's drink. And that's the moment when they, Dr. Strangelove, they get the transmission on the radio thing on their plane. And there's wing attack plan R happens at that moment. And they're like, oh, this can't be right. What? And it's the signal. I think that Kubrick is using those. He's telling us, hey, look, number 7, number 42. Like, I think there's a lot. There's many more that I probably don't know about. And people should look at the timeline. Because that is another entire piece of knowledge. It's a way of communicating information. And why wouldn't he utilize that? He's a genius.
The forethought and the precision that went into these artistic choices, it's incredible. It's like you were saying, you've seen it so many times, but you're still finding new information. And it's like peeling back layers of the onion. And it's crazy just how much went into it. It's really astounding.
Yeah, they did documentaries. There's Stanley Kubrick's Boxes is really good, where it's just, they just talk about all of his study that he's done for each movie and how he's categorized everything. And there's a whole wall of boxes. And the guy was talking about this whole This entire wall of boxes is photographic prints of doorways from New York City. He just wanted to look at doors. He's just sent out teams of photographers. Like, he sent out one photographer who had to get up onto a ladder because, like, when you take a photograph and you're on the ground, you look up at a building. Mm. The lines change because of the perspective. So you have to be up and straight on in order to get the lines straight. So this dude had a ladder and he was climbing 12 foot up on the ladder and he did the whole street. He was like, move the ladder 5 feet. Okay. Click, 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 click. And like, they put it all together so that Kubrick didn't have to go to New York. He could just be there in London or whatever, in St. Albans. Just that amount, just of photographic research. Then all the books that he reads and all of that stuff goes into his brain. He looked at all those photographs, that whole wall. Like, he was interested enough.
Right.
Just to create, and he's like, this is for the red door of Domino's door. Then if you look at the significance of the red door, and how that relates to the other movies, this is all of visual elements that are very important to him. No wonder he has all of these boxes, because he's creating these certain points of significance. So, like, there is a lot of study. It is documented. I think there's an artist, you can go and look at the boxes. I think it's on display at some college in England. A good friend of mine went and looked stuff up talking about NASA, Brett Carollo. He does PSYOP cinema, and people should go and listen to that episode. He teaches me things about how Kubrick is connected to Germans. I think that there's a lot more to learn, really.
Yeah. And I think that with Kubrick, I think we've just touched on the tip of the iceberg when it comes to him and the symbolism that he had in his films and just the deeper rabbit holes you can take. I know that we're really skimming the surface here. So I definitely recommend anybody who's really curious about diving deeper and really getting into breakdowns by film and by topic, definitely go check out Sean's work, because he goes in very deep, because it's just, there's just so much to it. That down into, you know, an hour. That's tough.
Right. And I also document, I'll show how Lolita lines up with Eyes Wide Shut, and I'll put those movies together. So you can see for yourself The Shining, how that, and then all 10 of them together. I put that together for people to see, and they can find all that on Wake the Dead, Odyssey, and Rumble. I love all of it. And just the thrill of learning new stuff and sharing. So you'll always find something with Wake the Dead. I'm not going to quit. And and if you're sick of the Kubrick stuff, there's plenty of other Black Pill subjects to deep dive into on my channel. So that too.
Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your insights.
Wonderful. I'd be delighted to return. I think that's great. And I like your show. I think it's like the presentation, and you've got a great voice, and I hope that you have more listeners. I think that would be wonderful.
Thank you. I appreciate that. As this conversation comes to a close, it just reminds us that some stories aren't meant to be resolved. They're meant to stay with us, quietly unfolding over time. Stanley Kubrick's work has a way of doing that. It lingers and it echoes long after the credits roll. Something about it continues to surface. I want to thank my guest, Sean McCann of Wake the Dead, for joining me this week and sharing his perspective. Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Dark Florida. If you would like to connect with the show, you can find us on Instagram at Dark Florida Podcast and subscribe to us on YouTube at youtube.com/@DarkFlorida411. If you have a story or experience you would like to share, email me at darkfloridapodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. If you would like to support the show, you can do so at buymeacoffee.com/darkflorida. Or wherever you're listening, drop a 5-star review and share the show with a friend. It really helps. And remember, some mysteries don't ask to be solved. They ask to be noticed. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.